Welcome to Pit Pass Moto, the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings you the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. I'm Dale Spangler.
I'm Dave Sawecki. And this week we have Jimmy Lewis as our guest. This week's industry spotlight, we'd like to talk about power sports industry trade shows. The AIM Expo, it soon begins in Las Vegas in late January, and we recently saw the cancellation of the Parts Unlimited MVP event, which is in Louisville, Kentucky, later in the month, due to COVID concerns mainly. We have also witnessed many other industry events change, alter their approach, or become discontinued altogether. What can we take away from these starts and stops, and does this impact how we do business going forward? No question the power sports industry has been wondering what to do about when, how, and where to present itself to the world, and that's been going on for more than 5 years. When the dealer news events finally stopped back in 2017 and AIM tried to pick up where they left off, the trade side of the business has really never felt the same. And some wonder if trade shows are even needed now, since the ability to launch new products has become more of a virtual exercise than something you do face-to-face. Anyone could argue both sides of this, and the evidence from the successful performance racing industry show in Indianapolis not too long ago would make somebody think nothing has really changed or should change.
For this week's moment in moto history, we'd like to celebrate the first American to win the Dakar Rally in the motorcycle class, Ricky Brabec. Ricky took home his unprecedented win in 2020.
Yeah, and going back to 1979, American racers had not been able to break the top step of the podium until 2020. And Brabec, riding that CRF 450 Rally modified Honda, he was able to take home the win after his fifth attempt in the series. And this is, in of itself, it should be recognized. And also, the win was a redemption for Brabec because he led the event in 2019 until he had a catastrophic engine failure.
Yeah, it's really cool what Brabec has done. Being the first American, I feel like he's opened the door for other Americans to step up and go for the win or podium. And Dakar, we're seeing some notable new people in this year's Dakar Rally, which we'll talk about with our upcoming guest. Yeah, there's some interesting fact about Brabec and his Honda win in 2020 as this broke an 18-year KTM win streak. Wow, I had no idea it was that long of a win streak, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely, and they seem to have a stranglehold on it this year. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how this race event shapes up over the rest of the week, and we're all watching to see how they do, man.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Upcoming races, we have the Kicker AMA Arena Cross Series rounds 4 and 5 at the Lazy E Arena in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, January 21st and 22nd. January 22nd, we have round 3 of the AMA Supercross Series at Petco Park in San Diego, California. January 23rd, the World Off-Road Championship Series, also known as WRCS, kicks off in Prim, Nevada. Back east, the U.S. Sprint Enduro Series also starts at Maurice Paradise in Sellers, South Carolina on January 23rd. And finally, back out west, the National Hare and Hound Series gets its start in Lucerne Valley, California on January 23rd. Welcome to Pit Pass Moto, Jimmy Lewis. How are you today, Jimmy?
I'm actually really good, other than I'm not riding right now.
So as we record this episode, Jimmy, we're a little over halfway through Dakar. It's been pretty chaotic, to say the least. We've seen a lot of changes from day to day, with overall contenders losing huge chunks of time because of tricky navigation, riders not wanting to lead out, and even stage six being canceled. So what are your thoughts so far on this year's Dakar?
It's been a wild Dakar for sure. It's getting set up for the top guys now to be an incredible finish. Four more days, you're going to see, I mean, there's always been a little bit of strategy being played out, but you're going to see in the next 4 days, a ton of strategy, not just with the top riders, but, you know, utilizing their teams to their advantage. You have a bunch of different manufacturers and brands that are in contention. So it's set up to be a real epic finish, and these guys are going to pin it.
So, Jimmy, I'm wondering, as a racer in this situation, as you're more than halfway through, what's going through their minds right now? What are these guys plotting, thinking? Are they panicking? Are they calculating? What's the mindset?
Their minds, unfortunately, are probably a little bit numb because they have raced for, you know, a little bit over a week. So they had 6 days, a rest day. And I think what was yesterday was day eight. So they're 2 days past the rest day. And the rest day isn't much of a rest day these days because they're doing so much media. But at this point, you're relying on what we'll call your base mileage, the training you've been doing all year long. And it's kind of, at this point, really keeping your head together. And we've seen, like you saw Daniel Sanders go out on a liaison, which is just almost unheard of. But then you start hearing the circumstances of what happened. It was dark. It was super early in the morning. He essentially hit a curb on a sort of a roundabout or a turnout. And this kind of stuff, when it happens, is not surprising. But at the same time, it just shows you what level these guys are stressed to. But I think they're kind of on autopilot to a certain extent, a lot of them. But now, I guess, it's like you've done your qualifiers, you know, in the Supercross, and now you're lining up for the main event. It's just going to take 4 days.
So, Jimmy, with you being a former Dakar podium finisher and a double class winner, from your perspective, I mean, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in recent years with the Dakar rally since your time? Like, I mean, a couple examples, you know, like, is it the bikes, like, you know, them going to 450s? Is it the navigation become more difficult, or is it the raw speed? I'm just curious what your, from your perspective, you know, how has the Dakar really evolved and changed?
Everything has changed. It's really, it's not the same race. And I guess when I look back at it, I would call myself a second or almost a third generation Dakar rider. And I would say now we're up to like six or seven generations, and generation not in being a, you know, a 10-year time period. It's kind of like how the race evolved. And it really started just a bunch of crazy guys saying, hey, we're going to race to Senegal. We're in Paris now. We're going to race to Senegal. And they didn't know what they were doing or how they were going to do it. They just did it. And I mean, probably a little bit like the very first Baja 1000, where guys just started in Tijuana and said, hey, we're going to race down to La Paz on whatever way we can get there. And then it became a race. And then people actually started maybe doing a little bit more planning and a little more strategizing. And then, you know, it changed based on, you know, the equipment got, you know, it advanced, the equipment evolved, the navigation became more of a thing. And when I did it, the race was 21 days long. And it was very point to point each day. You were covering a large distance and everybody was in the race. Like it wasn't, there were no motorhomes and there were, you know, all of your parts were in a truck that was actually entered in the race. And if that truck didn't race, your parts didn't get there. So it's evolved so much. And these guys, and not taking nothing away from them and what they're doing, the race now is so much about, you know, pure speed. And even the navigation is ridiculously difficult, but it's things that you kind of know. Well, now we go out and we really train and practice for this to understand kind of how to decode what the navigation really is and then do it without slowing down. And that's the kind of the essence of, you have 20 guys that are now capable of riding very fast and navigating, but then the way that they've started working on this navigation has started causing what we're seeing, this seesaw effect. So if you start, it's called starting or opening the stage. you're the first guy out and you're making the first track on the road. And then as there become more tracks and stuff, guys can sort of start following the tracks. They don't have to navigate as much because they can literally see the track. And so they're just sort of confirming the navigation. But yeah, it's an incredible journey what the Dakar has done, you know, going to different countries and continents and doing all this stuff and the way that the racing has evolved along with it. I don't know if we're in a great time for it other than it's, I mean, you think about it, ASO puts on the Tour de France and the Dakar, and they have just turned how to make a really good TV show out of an incredible race.
All part of the entertainment, I guess, is probably the takeaway on that. But just kind of shifting gears a little bit, Jimmy, obviously you've worked with training guys for Dakar, but go back to your website, where the Jimmy Lewis Off-Road Training website, where now you're also working with individuals to kind of teach them the off-road skills they need to compete and get better at what they do. I'm really interested to kind of hear your thoughts on how you work with riders and how you approach them and bring them into your program.
With Jimmy Lewis Off-Road, it's two real complete separate things, like the navigation training and the rider training. And in all honesty, most of my rider training is focused on, I would call it dual sport or adventure riders, or, you know, we're starting to get a little bit more popular with guys that just want to kind of increase their game, you know, in racing. But it's something I've been doing for more than 20 years now. And it started because some guy said, hey, if he's a BMW factory rider, he must know how to ride these big, giant, they weren't even called adventure bikes back then, these big, giant GSs, you know, off-road. And I learned I kind of had a knack for it, and I really enjoyed it. So we have it's kind of funny because I don't have like a level one or a level two or an advanced class. We have this one, we call it our series one class, and it's very basic riding techniques taken to an extremely, extremely high level. Because even when I do work with some really, really good riders, you realize that they're kind of struggling with some of the very basic techniques. Like they're leaving something out in the balance or the traction, and that's what's catching up to them now, even at a very high level. So a regular guy, even a guy who's been riding 20 years, can come out and we're essentially breaking bad habits or kind of dispelling some myths about riding. That's where we're at with that. And then we take the same approach to the navigation training. And we don't train those two things at the same time. Like people say, I want to do a sand dune riding course. And it's like, are you having a problem with riding in the sand, or are you having problem navigating? Which is it? I try to funnel things down to the very basics and figure out how to apply those and really get the student to understand what the real problem is, not smoke and mirrors coaching.
The takeaway I see is looking at your blog and riding tips and some of the instructional videos, where it seems like you've broken it down to the basic steps so that people can understand how and why things happen, rather than just, you know, here's how you do it, because there's two ways of teaching, right? So I think you've done a good job of explaining the basics so that they can understand it and learn it. And I think, as you said, apply it to the larger motorcycles later.
Yeah, and we, you know, it's funny because we're kind of known for the adventure bike training. I encourage people to come out. I'm like, come out and take the class on a smaller bike. And they're like, but I don't really want to ride those. And they want to ride, you know, the adventure bikes. And it's the adventure bike is, it actually, as much as it's harder to ride, it also masks a lot of the problems that the rider is creating. Because it, you know, like I said, it comes down to balance. And it's really, believe it or not, once that adventure bike starts moving, it's a lot harder to knock it out of balance. And the small bike, it really shows you what you were doing as a rider. And there's a lot of kind of correlation between, you know, we're trying to teach the rider to do things, and you can carry those skills onto any bike that you ride. So that's where we kind of get that technique.
So Jimmy, many have said, I think Eric Kudla probably being one of them, that the creation of the full gas sprinter Duro series has really helped American riders become podium threats in the ISDE. So likewise, I feel like what you, guys like you and guys like Quinn Cody are doing to help U.S. rally racers has really elevated the level of U.S. riders to podium and overall winner threats at Dakar Rally. So what is it about your training regimen that you would say is helping these riders like the 2020 Dakar winner Ricky Babeck take that step to the top of the podium in a race that's so difficult like Dakar?
It's really the fact that guys like Ricky and Andrew Short are willing to put in the work and really focus on the, whatever the next step is. And this is what's so awesome about working with top level athletes that are really on their game. And a lot of credit also goes to Johnny Campbell for actually, he kind of funneled a lot of the people that we've worked with. Any guy that you've seen do anything in the rally game from the United States, I've had some interaction or worked with them at some point or another. And you come in and you basically take this basic class. I don't care where you're at in your rally stuff. And then we start working on things. And we get to a point with these guys that you can tell they take what they learned and they go and they practice it. And then the really good guys come back and start asking questions. And they're like, hey, I was doing this, I was doing that. And so we have map books out here that literally focus on a specific skill. They literally have lessons built into them. And when you get to the level of where Ricky is at and where Andrew is at, these guys are coming back to me with problems, things that we see kind of the style of navigation training, you know, or the style of navigation they're using in the rally changing ever so slightly. And so it's up to us collectively to kind of figure out a way. And they challenge me with coming up with drills and techniques that will help them, you know, kind of kick it up to the next level. And luckily it's been really good. This year's a really bad example. And I guess my only explanation for it is they've made the navigation and they would like to call it tricky, but they've gone, in my opinion, they've gone to the point where that requires a certain amount of guessing and a little bit of luck. I don't like this because navigation is kind of a precision. There's a certain amount of precision or science to it. And if you get to a note and you do what it tells you to do exactly or as close as you can, and then you're still wrong, like you kind of at some point here had to guess what you were supposed to do, that's no longer navigation. And I think they did it a little bit. They're really doing it to slow the whole pace of the rally down. And it's working because you see the guys that are starting in the front, you know, every day losing 20 minutes to the guys that start 20 minutes back or farther. And there's this seesaw effect. And it's always been a little bit of that on a rally. But now when you trip up, you know, six of the top 20 guys in the game, they come to a note and they do it. And on day one, where so many guys got caught out, when they go do everything perfectly, and then even when things start going wrong, like let's just say it was a bad note and they start doing the techniques that we use to solve that problem, and they do all this perfectly, and it still costs you from 30 minutes to an hour based on when you arrived on the scene. I mean, it's tough to swallow. And I, you know, when these guys train all year long for a single event and it's thrown out in potentially, you know, one note, that's rough.
So Jimmy, when we get a guy like you on the show, we love to kind of pick your brain because you've been in the industry a long time, well known for that. I have to ask you kind of what your thoughts are, the future of the EV platform in motorcycling. And really, that's a pretty broad, big question. And there's some starts and stops, I think, with Alta and Zero that happened over the years. And now we see the Stark Varg coming along. I'm just kind of curious to get your opinion. What do you see as the future, or is there a future for EVs in motorcycling?
As a washed up ex-motorcycle journalist, well, I still do it a little bit. I've ridden pretty much every version of electric motorcycle. I have not ridden the Stark, but I rode the Zero and the Alta. And so I've ridden all the different versions, and it's getting better and it's getting better and it's getting better. But I still think that right now, the best electric bike out there, I haven't ridden a Stasic yet, but that might be the best one. But the OSET, I always told people the OSET's the best electric bike out there, because it's getting people into the game. It's easy to maintain. It requires a little bit of work and maintenance because it's not the build of a quality. And then I even rode that little KTM E50 or E5, they call it, which is an incredible motorcycle. Then you start looking at like this, the Stark and the different things. I don't think we're quite at the point And there was a lot of claims with that Stark that are really out there. And when you start digging around and listening to the things, you know, even in the videos you saw, they say, well, it's only really operating at 60% of what their claims are. And I think they're expecting that the battery technology is going to take a jump before they actually release that thing in November. Those are things that I, as a journalist, I would question. And I always said, I don't really know until I ride it. And then when I actually ride it, then I can tell you how it works. But it's coming. There's no doubt that, and you would be ridiculous to not think that you know, Honda and Yamaha and KTM have some stuff going on. And the reason you haven't seen it from them is that it's probably not ready for prime time just yet. And there's a lot of excitement and hype with this, but you're seeing it with the electric, electric vehicles on road, you know, cars and trucks and stuff. And it's getting better. But with the motorcycle, you're stressed with such a difficult packaging problem to try to fit all of this stuff inside of a thing. You know, how are you able to charge it as quickly as you need to? What kind of charging infrastructure do you need? You know, there's a lot of stuff that comes into play. But when you start looking at the reasons they're doing it, for the less sound, for the impact on riding areas, you know, to be able to go places where it was quiet. I heard some really interesting stuff about during COVID, a lot of these tracks pretty much shut down. And then people that lived near them started enjoying the peace and quiet. And then when they came back, it was like, hey, what? I don't like this. And this is a thing that we're going to have to pay attention to on the, you know, especially on the tracks that are close to civilization. It's coming. I'm excited for it. I know that compared to the first ones I rode, the Alta was absolutely phenomenal because the first ones were really horrible and not designed by motorcycle people. So it was, you know, they didn't understand power delivery, which is very important. And for sure, even the Alta, they didn't understand chassis performance. And that was one of the biggest downfalls with that.
So let me ask you one follow-up question to that then, because you hit on a few good points in it and it really struck me. And I've always wondered with the EVs, at least in our realm, right? We're dirt bike guys, we're off-road guys. And really that sensation of riding a motorcycle is fundamental to the experience. I just got to wonder, has the EV market really embraced that rider bike interface in a way that if they could resemble more what we have today, would they be more successful in getting buy-in from, you know, future riders? Because it seems like what they've offered to us so far has been so vastly different. You kind of hit on that it kind of throws people off.
I think that with any change or evolution, man, the motorcycle industry is probably the biggest bunch of dinosaurs I've ever seen. Like, you're going to put a power valve on that two-stroke? That'll never work. You know, things like the four-strokes, horrible. They'll never come back. You know, all these things. And this is what you kind of hear a little bit about the EV. And I think the biggest thing that we're going to have to get over is the sound. You know, the lack of sound. Because that's part of the riding experience. And I know this from when we train guys. There's some guys that ride by sound. And you take this out and then all of a sudden they realize their bike goes a lot faster when they actually feel the power as opposed to hear the power. And so that's probably the hurdle. But maybe some kids that are going to be coming up are never going to ride a gas motorcycle. They're going to start on an electric bike and then there'll be an electric 80 by the time they're ready to come off of their peewee sized bike. And we're going to have to change the names. What are we going to call them? You know, is it a, you know, an 8 as opposed to a 5? And then we get up to whatever the big ones are. So right now you're going to hear all the naysayers complain about the things that are easy to complain about and complain about stuff they don't know. But until you've actually ridden one, I don't think you can complain until you actually have some seat time on it and say, I like this or I like that and figure out what works. You know, you may be regulated into riding one of these at some point or another, and nobody likes that, but hopefully when that time comes, that the equipment is good enough to make it enjoyable, because I don't want to stop riding.
Well, the future certainly looks like it's going to be interesting from some of what we've already seen. Like you guys have mentioned, the Stark Varg, it's a pretty interesting looking machine. Jimmy, we really appreciate your time today. We could talk for hours about this. We did forget to mention that in your air quotes free time, you also run a website called dirtbiketest.com and also a podcast called Taco Talk Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. So
close enough. Tech Talk Taco Tuesday. I have a hard time saying it sometimes too, especially when we had, you know, had a beer or two.
Yeah. Where can people find you on the interwebs and on social to learn more about your off-road school and dirt bike test?
It's actually pretty easy. It's JimmyLewisOffroad.com is probably the main one. Again, dirt bike tests will kind of take you to all of the other things that we're doing. And pretty soon we're going to have a whole Better Rider podcast to help people so they can hopefully listen a little bit to how to become a better rider.
Once again, thank you, Jimmy. We appreciate your time today.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you again to our guests for being with us today, and thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. If you have a moment, please rate and review the show on your favorite podcast listening app. We really appreciate it. Make sure you're also following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and visit pitpassmoto.com, where you can check out our latest blog and our brand new Pit Pass Moto store.
This has been a production of Evergreen Podcasts. A special thank you to Tommy Boy Halverson, producer Leah Longbreak, and audio engineer Eric Coltnow. I'm Dave Sulecki.
And I'm Dale Spangler. See you next week on Pit Pass Moto.
Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and this is Pit Pass F1, a brand new podcast that'll take you closer to the action of the world's most prestigious motorsport. From Monaco to Miami and Australia to Azerbaijan, Pit Pass F1 is on the ground and has you covered. Esteemed F1 journalists Julianne Serasoli and Chris Medland will take you inside the sport every round. They'll keep you up to date with the latest news breaking in Formula One and the most influential views shaping the world of Grand Prix racing. Every Friday, we'll be bringing you a track guide and race preview, and Chris and Drew will be in your feed every morning from Saturday through to Monday to keep you up to date on all the day's action on and off the track. So if you want to be in the know on the latest in Formula One, subscribe wherever you get your favourite podcasts and visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com. Pit Pass F1, a brand new show for Evergreen Podcasts.